Everyone got one. What's your opinion? This is the rap room. Tongues won't be bit. Ain't no rules. Just spill it and anybody can get it. No limit. We get to kill it. You tuning into the thrillers. And no, ain't no stopping. Any topic. Even the rambling.
We get to win.
I hope that you're ready. We entering in the zone soon. We on a grown shit. Welcome to the rap room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it street, we keep it opinionated, we keep it wide.
100. Oh, wait, I messed up. Wait, we're doing it. I thought we did 5,000 last time. I think we changed it.
Let's do
1,000 and two.
I'll tell you in a second.
Okay. Rewind.
On the screen, on the Rant Room, we keep it street, we keep it opinionated, we keep it wide.
1,002. Because two is a nice round number.
See, all of our listeners know exactly what we're talking about. But, and you probably have heard it before. You hang around a bunch of college students,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So people always say we keep it 100, meaning sure. We keep it real, mm-hmm. right? So that's our little tag, you know, we always keep it 100. And then Bill Taub was on, and Bill's like, you guys got to go up higher than that. You guys are way better than that.
Yeah. We need to go up our game.
We went up to, like, 102 at one point, and then we did 1,002. Then last week we
it's
did
like 5,000. So
I like,
you know,
1,002.
Okay, we'll use that one.
Because some people on like the East Coast, a lot of people say keep it 1,000.
Yeah.
So
are you going to keep going up? Or
I don't know.
Might as well. We might say keeping it infinity. I don't know. That doesn't make sense. Okay.
So y'all hear us on the Rant Room. You know how we do. But on this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture. But our focus is always screenwriting, the craft, stories, shit like that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can curse on this show.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you guys. I saw you get upset the other day.
We grown.
Anyway, so y'all hear her voice. That's my girl. That's Lisa Volkhauser.
Hey, I want to give this shout out to Jasmine.
Why?
Because I was talking on Twitter and Facebook, and people.
I know
last time I think I might have mentioned that, you know, when I saw Gone Girl, I thought, you know what? You know, he's going to get nominated for an Oscar. He ain't going to win. I'm talking about Ben Affleck.
Okay.
But I just saw Nightcrawler.
Mm-hmm.
Baby.
Jake Gyllenhaal, he got it.
This makes up for Prince of Persia on so many levels. This, I mean, the writing, the acting, this is like one of the best dramas I've seen in a long, long time. He is going to get nominated for an Oscar right now. So Jasmine, because Jasmine was like, say, how much you willing to bet? So Jasmine, I told you on Facebook, $5 and a bag of Doritos.
Jasmine's one of the baby
rides. But so Jazz, this one's for you. I'm going to up it a little bit. Let's say $20.
Money.
In fact, I'm going to say, you know what? Jake Gyllenhaal is the one to beat in terms of Oscar. I still got a couple more movies I got to check out.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just the nuanced performance, this is the first time I've seen a character that's like on the spectrum. And when I say on the spectrum, his character is kind of like someone who could be autistic, could have Asperger's. It's like one of the most, I would love to sit down and say, how did you craft this? How did you create this character? Because mm-hmm. the moment he was on screen, there was never a dull moment. The whole time as a screenwriter watching it, I was like, well, shit, what would I do? How would I write this? And it says so much stuff. It's such a... I was so impressed.
Is this part of your clapback or you just...
This, you know what? I know it's not my clapback, but I just felt like I got to put that money down early on. So Jasmine, $20 and not a bag of Doritos. We're going to make it like a bag of like really fancy Trader Joe's, like sea salt and olive oil potato chips or something like that.
You know, so. I'll tell you who else to put money on. Yeah, I saw the other night is Steve Carell in Foxcatcher.
Really?
Yeah, he's amazing. He transforms himself into this really twisted, sick, demonic character, John DuPont.
Little Steve Carell.
Steve Carell, you don't even see Steve Carell in it. He's got this incredible makeup job. I mean, he's
okay.
Just,
note to self. Let me go see that too.
Pretty extraordinary performance.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, he keeps you on edge. You don't know which way he's going to go,
right.
What he's going to say. Mm. It's pretty out there.
Man,
yeah.
Man. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there. You haven't seen Nightcrawler? Go see it.
Okay.
And put your money down. Eventually, we're going to have our Oscar pool, but right now, I'm just saying it for the record, because y'all know I'm pretty good at this Oscar picking thing. Jake Gyllenhaal right now is the one to beat. I'm going to go check out Steve Carell, but right now, JG, baby.
That was up. You see how we do it on the rant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's why we call it the rant room. Sometimes we go sideways, motherfuckers. We go sideways. Yeah. So, look. Y'all hear her? That's Lisa Bolacaja. We call her Barry. We call her the street.
That's a street nerdist.
Okay. Why we call you that?
Right. Because I can give it to you for real, for real.
And why else?
And then
why
I can else? Give it to you for extra real with some some notations to back me up.
Dot dot period.
Okay. Some annotations for you.
That's what's up. So I told you we crazy out here. So, hey.
Yes.
If you're grown, mm-hmm. let's go ahead and
here we
get
go.
It in.
Here we go.
So, we got my man on the show. Everybody, y'all motherfuckers, we got a veteran on the show who's been around for a long time, knows the game. My man, Barry Sandler, writer, producer, instructor. Do you ever direct?
Never directed, no.
Never, you ever directed?
Never anything? Wanted to direct, really? Just wanted to write.
Yes.
You want to write, right. Huh?
Yep. He is pure.
So he the man sitting next to the
He's
man,
He's the
right?
writer.
Wanted to work with great directors and have. Yeah. Never, mm-hmm. yeah.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. So we got my man Barry Sandler on here, you guys. I'm talking veteran from way back. He's done some pretty important movies, let's say that. But what I want to talk about now, because we're going to get into all those.
Okay.
But... Everybody, I'm telling you guys right now, because we're going to drop this early. Usually we put one out every week. Today, this is going to be like a bonus episode. Because Barry Sandler has a new movie called Knock 'Em Dead. Let's give everybody just a little gist of what it is, a little premise about what the show, what the movie is. But let me just give you a quick little thing, guys. It stars Ray Don Chong, Deborah Wilson, Anne-Marie Johnson, Jack A., Phil Morris. I mean, some big heavies in there.
Omarosa.
Oh, and Omarosa forgot.
Yes, right. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. And her film debut. Yeah, she's very funny. She's terrific.
And
yeah.
And for the record, she really is nice. It's some bullshit.
Oh, yeah, she's
Let
great.
Me tell you.
She's terrific. She really is terrific, yeah.
Just one of Pam's girls.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a comedy mystery with some horror elements, but it's
people
kind of
people do die, right?
Yeah, people do die in very strange ways. Mm-hmm. But it's a kind of a poking fun at Hollywood and the fame game and people who want to be famous at any cost, and it's basically the premise is there was a horror film 10 years ago in the kind of a Scream film, in which the cast and crew was a big hit, but everybody hated each other's guts and they just didn't want to work together again. But in the 10 years, they've all become desperate and destitute and out of work and really needing work. And the producer decides to try to get a sequel off the ground, but in order to do so, he's got to bring them all together again to work together. Okay. So he arranges for this secluded island mansion for them all to get together, which was the scene of the original film, and try to see if they can all become friendly and be able to work. And right away, they just hate each other's guts all over again. Start bitching and
they go back to where they were.
Yeah, just cutting each other apart. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, a murder happens, and then another murder, and they're trapped on the island. They can't get off, and the murders happen in the same way that they happen in the actual movie.
So it becomes like a whodunit. Huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So our three leading ladies, who are Ray Dawn and Deborah Wilson and Anne-Marie Johnson, have to band together and put aside all their old grievances and try to find the killer and save their own lives.
Mm-hmm. And what's funny about that is like, if the killer is killing them in the same order as the original movie, the person who survived at the end is probably feeling quite comfortable. Like, I got some time, so that would make me suspicious. Like,
well, there's a few surprises and twists and turns. Yeah, through all
the... You gotta have your little red hands.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, through all the bitchy lines and the dialogue and the camping and the fun, there's a mystery going on. Mm. But it goes on video on demand starting November 7th.
Okay.
It's Comcast and iTunes and Amazon and Verizon and Dish and all the VODs.
Wow.
It's going wide. It's in a couple of theaters in some cities, but primarily video on demand, and then it'll be on DVD in February. Okay. Because
I do want to talk to you later once we get to the game. I want to talk about your career and how you got into the game and all that stuff like that. But when we get back to Knock 'Em Dead, I do want to talk about how you made the film, because I believe you originally wrote it just as a normal white cast.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
It. So I want to talk about that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that, sure.
Especially with my girl in here, because she's like Miss Horror Buff.
Right. Well, let me just say that the film was directed by David Dakota, who's a known and cult horror director. He's done a lot of terrific. The Brotherhood and he's all the Brotherhood sequels, and he's been working for years. And in fact, I met him on the set of one of my. He was working on the set of one of my films early on in the '80s, and we've maintained a friendship all.
Wait, was the Brotherhood? Is that the one that was like with the werewolves?
Yes.
Thinking of that, yeah. And it was like overly. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And all the sequels. Yeah. He's done about 50, 60 films, you know.
Wow.
The horror,
okay.
In the horror genre.
I remember
genre.
That, too.
Yeah. 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 I got to meet him when he was a little annoyed the other day, though. Long story short, we won't go deep into
it. He's generally a very calm, easygoing guy, but.
I'm on the committee, the Gay and Lesbian Being Committee, actually with Barry at the Writers Guild. And we were going to screen his film on Monday. And there was an issue with the sound. So we had all these people coming, all the stars of the film coming, and we couldn't show the film. So we had to cancel it and move it to Thursday night, which will be tonight when this drops.
Yes.
So, it was an interesting...
Yes, it was. They put in a new sound system for tonight, so...
They damn well should.
So, yeah.
They needed to. So, unfortunately, you had to be the brunt of it, though.
Well, okay, what can you do?
Like,
what
don't they check that stuff before they get started? Or did just it just happen right in the middle of it, just blew out?
I think it's been on its downside, even though it's new.
It happened when they were trying out the Blu-ray. So, fortunately, it didn't happen during the movie when we were showing it. Yeah. So, it was, you know, we got in time.
So, anyway, I just wanted to get that one out the way so everybody could start... All you listeners, go online right now. Check out the trailer to Knock 'Em Dead. It's a trip.
Good.
It's a trip.
Okay.
So let's go back into you a little bit. Where are you from? How you got into the writing game?
Okay.
You know, how it all happened for you.
Well, I'm one of these, you know, people that started writing when I was 7 years old. I would start writing short stories. And, that was my
when
one
I was two
single.
Oh God, yes. You could tell writers when they're young. It shows when they're little already. Like you could tell.
Well, you know, when everybody else was, out in the street playing, football or baseball, I was home writing stories. Aww. You know. So.
I love that.
And.
Are you a nerd, Barry?
Yeah,
you're cool. You're a cool nerd.
I would say a cool nerd. Okay, all right.
Got that Florida tan.
Okay. Right.
Anyway, so I was always driven to. That was my single, goal was to, and I love movies, so I wanted to merge, my writing with film and write movies. So that was my determination to come out to Hollywood and be a screenwriter. So I went to UCLA Film School, applied to UCLA and SC, went to UCLA as an undergrad and a grad, and got a BA in screenwriting and an MFA in screenwriting, and actually started writing professionally while I was still in college. Had an interesting experience happening where it was in the early 70s, and I had written a script about the roller derby.
Those roller derby.
Remember Skinny Minnie Miller and all those.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Remember the roller derby?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like wrestling and roller derbies. That was like, they went hand in hand.
Yeah, well, I was fascinated by, I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, so I was coming, from the east out to California. So I really wasn't that familiar with roller derby, and I got out here and went to one of these and just was fascinated by it and thought just the crowd and the reaction and I knew it was all phony and bullshit. But,
How dare you, Barry?
But
that is real.
But what was fascinating was the crowd believed it. The crowd bought into it and they really,
Because you would see blood.
Yeah.
So you would think it was real.
Yeah, well, here's what it was. It crossed the line many times because the fighters, the skaters, there were all these grievances that they had off the rink and off the skating, and they would carry on that onto the rink. So they would take out their hostilities on each other. So it sometimes escalated into something much more, than phony. I mean, it did get real at times, and the crowd really, cried out for blood. I mean, it was one of these. Okay. It was like a blood sport thing.
Child, I spit at the roller rink,
and it was just this great subculture.
Yes,
this great subculture. It's colorful. It was down at the Olympic Auditorium. Remember the Olympic Auditorium downtown? This kind of seedy, decrepit old crumbling building.
Awesome.
And I thought, what a great backdrop for a movie, and what a great character one of these women roller derby skaters would be. And at the time. Raquel Welch was the, pop culture diva. I mean, it was the early 70s.
God. And 10,000 BC or,
And I thought just to merge that concept of the pop culture diva into the role of a roller derby queen just would be something pretty Amazing. So I wrote the script with her in mind, and this was kind of a little bit a little ballsy on my part. Mm-hmm. I found out where she lived.
That's a hustler
right there.
Yeah. Well, remember they usually have these maps to the movie stars' homes that mm-hmm. they would pedal off on Sunset Boulevard. Mm-hmm. So I got one of these, found out where she lived, and drove up to her house, pulled up to the front of the house, and it was this big.
See, y'all can do that in the 70s. Nowadays, you do that. They'd be like, you going to jail there.
I tell my own students, don't ever do this now. You can't do it now. You get shot.
Okay.
So I found the house. It was up in Bennett Canyon. Mm-hmm. And I parked the car and took my script and went up to the front door and rang the doorbell. And her assistant answered the door, and I said, I was at UCLA Film School at the time, and I told her, I said, I have the script that I wrote for Raquel, and I think she's going to love it. And you know, the assistant was quite taken aback by it. I said, well, it's highly unusual. I said, look, just will you read it, and if you like it, give it to her. And
what a smart move, yeah. Barry. It's like, and look, you look at it, and then you let me know.
And that's what happened. She read it and liked it, and gave it to Raquel. And Raquel read it, liked it, and the next thing we were in business.
How long did it take from the time you dropped it off to the time you heard from them?
Well, there was other things that were going on because I. It took a long time because she was in Europe at the time and doing another movie, mm-hmm. and by the time she got back and got to read it, it was many weeks, I would say. Mm-hmm. And at one point I wrote her a letter. She was a little bit concerned about the invasion of privacy, understandably. And her assistant called me and said, you know, she's a little bit unnerved by that. So I wrote her a letter and saying I didn't mean anything by it. I really, you know, really just stating that I was doing this with the best of intentions. And that letter got her to read the script. And when she read the script, she said, yeah, I want to do this movie. Yeah. And I would say maybe, you know, 6 or 8 weeks from the time I dropped
it. Yeah. And especially in 70s time with no email and none of that stuff. Just
the next Sunday we were making a deal, and the film got made, and it was the last. Remember Life magazine when they went out of business around 72. Yeah. This is the last movie cover. It was Raquel on the cover, and the film ended up being a big hit. Wow. It was released in the summer of 72.
Tell the audience the name of that movie.
The new movie is The Kansas City Bomber,
and that was the movie. That's the movie that got me in trouble at Palisades Roller Rink because we were skating. I was little, and we were skating, and I was trying to do some of the Raquel moves with the stuff, and my mother was like, "Will you stop that?" I'm like, "And you see how movies influence young people." But it was just such a big thing. One thing to see, you know, roller derby stuff on TV, but didn't see a movie about it. And we love Raquel.
And they made you feel like you were really.
Oh God, yeah. So like me and my friends, we'd be out there in little skates, we had the old school skates. Y'all remember the skates? Okay, I'm really dating myself. We had the skates where you can like inch them out as your feet grew with the little key thing, and we'd be out there trying to be like that stuff. So I thank you, Barry, for getting me in trouble.
Young Jodie Foster.
Happy to do it. Yeah. Oh yes, and Jodie Foster played her daughter in the movie.
Yes, funny, and you know I'm a huge Jodie Foster fan, I was in heaven.
Yes, indeed.
Kansas City Bombers.
So what was next? So what happened after that?
Well, then I finished school. I used the script as my master's thesis at UCLA. Really? Yeah.
I was going to ask you, did everybody hate you at school? Like,
they love the story.
I would think, if anything, it'd be like, whoa, this guy.
They use the story to promote the film school because, UCLA film student gets movie made. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So, and that funny, that story has haunted me all these years. People still, you know, come to me and say, oh, you're that guy who dropped that script off to Raquel Welch.
Like, I think I might have heard this story.
Well, her husband at the time was a PR guy, Pat mm-hmm. Curtis. And he played that up because he thought it would be great promotion for the film. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it sort of stuck in the culture at the time and has carried over and followed me through. Wow. But so once I was out of school, I started writing, you know, professionally and continued to do so. And
so did agents and everybody hit you after that?
Well, I had an agent at the time.
Oh, you did?
Yes. In fact, it was ICM. They... I knew that they wanted to get the script to Raquel, but I knew it was going to end up on a pile with 35 other scripts. So that's when I took it upon myself to take action.
No. Okay.
Which I would encourage anybody who wants to write today to not to follow a star and stalk a star, but to take action on their own.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
I don't mean to take you a step back. However, I think it's really important. Even though I know the times were different and probably how the rules worked with agents and stuff might have been a little bit different there, how did you meet your agent then? Because kids need to hear, the stories and how landed.
It's a good question, how I landed an agent then. Well, and it's not that much different today. Mm-hmm. The Writers Guild publishes a list of all the agents. And
anybody can get it. You don't have to.
Yeah, anybody can get it. Now you can get it online. Then you just went to the guild and they would get a copy. But you just start making calls or emailing or finding out who will read material from new writers. Sure. And I started making calls and I had a script an original script that I had written and used that as a sample script. Mm-hmm. Started calling agents and. There was a young agent who was just starting out at ICM. At that time, it was called CMA. It hadn't merged with IFA to form ICM at the time. But he said, I'd be interested in reading your script, and which is unusual because I know it's a little tougher at the bigger agencies. But at that time, it was just at the advent of the explosion of the film school writer and director. And
so they would have 100,000 writers trying to get it.
Exactly. Yeah. You didn't. Yeah. So he was willing to read it, and it was Jeff Berg at CMA at the time, and he very much liked it, and he gave me a call and said, "Come on in, let's talk about it." He signed me, pretty much right there on the spot.
Uh-huh.
And once I had an agent, it was a lot easier. But
once you did the Raquel Welch thing, that gave him ammunition.
Exactly.
To get other things.
Exactly, because the film turned out to be success.
Now the letter that you wrote to Raquel apologizing, did you get smart and just have your ICM have the envelope on there?
I didn't. You just wrote it for yourself? Yeah, because at that part, at that time, I was operating outside the bounds of ICM.
Gotcha.
My agent wasn't aware that I was going through it, that I did all this.
Okay.
Once I didn't want, because I knew he would be pissed.
Mm-hmm.
But once she decided she wanted to do the movie, then I told him, because at that point, it was a deal.
Of course they would be like, well, good for you, Barry, yay.
Yeah. But
as opposed to what?
He would have... hit the roof if he knew that I was doing this, outside the bounds of the agency. So, but sometimes you got to break the rules to get ahead. So.
Well, if you hadn't done that,
exactly.
How would things have been?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. So you finished college and then you started really focusing on writing.
Yes. Yeah. So the next script I wrote, we sold it to Warner Brothers, which was The Duchess and the Dirtwater Fox, which is kind of a Western comedy. And it was Goldie Hawn, but it went into turn on at Warner's and was picked up by 20th Century Fox. And the director was Mel Frank, who had just had scored a hit movie with Touch of Class, remember, mm-hmm. Glenn Jackson, George Siegel, and wanted to do it. And we got it set up at Warner's and then at Fox. Mm-hmm. And I did a film with Sidney J. Fury. Remember Sidney Fury's terrific director who had just done Lady Sings the Blues with Diana Ross, the Billie Holiday story, which is a terrific movie. Mm-hmm. And I met Sidney, and we had breakfast together, and he had read a couple of my scripts and wanted to get together and talk ideas. And he had an idea about doing this love story of Clark Gable and Carol Lombard.
Mm-hmm.
And... I thought it was a great story. I remember my mother was a huge fan of both of them, and mm-hmm. I was a little young at the time to know who they were, but I did a lot of research, and Sidney and I got together, and I went off and wrote the script, and we sold the script to Universal.
That's based off a real story.
Yeah, it was. I did a lot of research, and it's a true story of Clark Gable and Carol Lombard and their love affair. And he was married at the time, and they had to sneak around, and we're dealing with the morals of the 30s and 40s.
Like Spencer Tracer and Catherine Hepburn,
very much so. Yeah, yeah. So it was a lot of fun to do that movie. James Brolin was Clark Gable, and Jill Clayburgh, who was terrific.
Yeah.
And Brolin was terrific, too, as Gable, but Clayburgh as Lombard is a a lot of fun making that movie because Universal spared no expense. And
let me ask you a question. So you're doing all these movies, was especially back in, like, I'm thinking like in the 70s and 80s. We're going to move into the 80s in a minute.
Right.
But that was like where it really started with no writers allowed on the set. Were you
I was very fortunate, yes, because I worked with directors who were not threatened by the writer on the set. I mean, okay. Sydney really invited my presence on there, really wanted me there, as somebody to bounce ideas off of. So I've been fortunate in my career to be able to work with directors. Wow. Now, there are a couple of times where I had in my contract that, which is rare, it's hard to get, but when you have an original screenplay and they want it badly enough, you can make that demand that as a writer they can't replace you. Now, we all as writers know that that's kind of the optimum, to get that. And you'll never get it if you're a writer for hire, if you're doing an assignment.
Right.
But if you write an original screenplay, they want it, and you say, yeah, you can have it, but, and I won't take that much money for it, but I want creative control. In other words, I want the fact, the guarantee that no other writer will come aboard. I'll be glad to make changes and work with the director on it. So in a couple of instances, I had that clause in the contract, so I was able to maintain my presence throughout the shoot. But at the same time, I working with Ken Russell or Arthur Hiller or Sidney Fury or David Dakota, people like that who are not writers but welcome the presence of the writer. Now, any writer, as we all know, would love that experience of being around and being there to, talk to the director about how a scene is going. And the director at the same time, wants the writer there because if he's rehearsing a scene and a line isn't playing, if the writer's there, he'll say, hey, can you change that line? Or the actor will say, I'm uncomfortable saying this line. Can we rework it? I know when I worked with Christopher Walken on a movie, he there were lines that he had, questions about, and he would come up to me and say, do you mind if, I said it this way or whatever? And if I wasn't there, he wouldn't have that option to, So I've been fortunate in being able to be a presence on a lot of the movies. Not every movie. I mean, there's a couple times where I wasn't allowed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one time when I actually got kicked off the set in England. Yeah.
Were you causing a ruckus on set, Barry?
I was doing The Mirror Cracked with Elizabeth Taylor and Kim Novak and Rock Hudson and Tony Curtis and Angela Lansbury.
Rock Hudson.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, but I was a writer for hire on that. There was an existing script by a British writer, and they wanted an American writer to Americanize the film. So I came in and did the rewrite, but I changed it considerably and was invited over to London when they were shooting to be there on the set. Mm-hmm. And this is interesting because, as I mentioned earlier, I've worked with directors who really welcomed my presence, but at the same time, a writer has to know his or her bounds on a set and know when, at what point they're able to cross the line and talk to an actor. Mm-hmm. And I think you always have to work with the director to maintain that balance, to maintain that camaraderie, really. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to cross the line and where you're taking advantage of the situation. So I found it's very important for writers, if they're working with directors, to be very savvy and politic about it, about knowing what the boundaries are and not knowing when not to cross them. So I did, it was an instance where I did cross the line, where I was in England and one of the actors asked me to if they could have lunch with me to discuss the script because they weren't getting the feedback they wanted from the director. Mm-hmm. And I said, of course, and not knowing, not even bringing it up with the director, just, doing it. Mm-hmm. And the director found out about it and was not happy about it, thinking I went behind his back. Mm-hmm. So he kindly asked
me. Was it Liz?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. No, in fact, she was great. I mean,
it's like, darling, let's talk about the script.
I have to tell you, working with Elizabeth Taylor, I'll get back to finish the story, but working with Elizabeth Taylor, Lisa, that you brought it up, she's probably the only actor I've ever worked with and all the actors I've worked with who said every line exactly as written.
Yeah.
Total professional. Mm-hmm. Not that the other actors weren't, but she, said the lines as they were written and ate with the cast and crew and joked around, and it was just a total pro.
Mm-hmm.
And none of this.
Not quite the diva.
No diva bullshit. Yeah. None at all. None at all. Yeah. No, absolutely not. It was just a pleasure to work with her. It was great. And, as a kid, she was like, I idolized Taylor. Yeah. I mean, the idea of working with Elizabeth Taylor. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because she was a last-minute replacement on that film for another actress that I adored growing up, who was Natalie Wood.
Oh, wow.
And, in fact, I had several meetings with Natalie Wood on the film before we shooting and just was in love with her. I just thought she was great. Mm-hmm. And she was terrific. I mean, she really respected the writer and really, again, being a child star, as was Taylor, mm-hmm. really grew up in the business, you know, surrounded by writers sure. and directors. So that was great. But she had a row with the director and walked off the movie. The same director who threw me off the set. So wow. She was, in fact, the producer one time called me and said, I have good news and bad news. I said, what's the bad news? He said, Natalie's left the movie. And I was pretty, you know, upset about that. He said, don't you want to hear the good news? I said, what is it? He said, Elizabeth Taylor just signed. Suddenly, I became happy again. After I had this experience having lunch with one of the actors, the director kindly asked me to return to Los Angeles on the next plane, which I did. However, interestingly enough, he wanted me to rewrite the next script that he was doing.
Oh, really?
So
he still saw.
He still, respected my ability as a writer.
Maybe his concern was like, you know what? Let's not have this happen again.
Yeah,
Send you away.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you at least take some snacks with you from the honey wagon when you
left? Ah, yes. Of course.
Like if I travel this far, I'm taking the plate of ribs with me.
Yes. And you know, in England, the way they do with the honey wagon, with the lunch wagon. It's there all day. You can just go whenever you want. So
some other craft services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, craft services. Uh-huh. Yeah. So
just take that bag full of snacks. Okay, I'm leaving.
Give me three pancakes.
Goodness.
So what was next after?
Next was Making Love. So
here we go.
Yeah,
you remember that one?
That
changed some shit.
Mm-hmm.
Well. Yeah, thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm. That was a
for
pretty.
The kids, we get a lot of people who are like in their 20s. Listen, let's just tell them what this movie is.
Now, look, y'all heard this. Say this before.
Go ahead.
You need to go back and study film and watch some shit. So when people say something that you don't know, what is that? You need to Google it and find it and get it on Netflix and watch these movies because you'll learn a lot from the classics. That's all I'm going to say.
That's all I'm going to say.
I agree. Absolutely. I tell my students. I mean, that you can learn a lot from these classic films.
And you can steal shit. That's from a long time ago.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
All right.
Well, we say be inspired by. You know? So, but it's true.
The whole monologue inspired me. I just figured I'd take it out of there and put it in my mind.
I'm going to borrow some shit.
I learned a lot from watching old movies as a kid. And I tell students today, look, if you're writing a detective story, watch Chinatown.
Yes.
Watch, Double Indemnity. Mm-hmm. Watch some
and
of the great
the scripts too.
Film noir, mm-hmm. And read the scripts.
Right.
Absolutely, yes, because you learn a lot. You are, you can see how structure and character develops, and particularly a lot of these films are much more character based.
Right.
And there's a lot in terms of how you introduce a character and elements of construction.
Right.
That are important for all of us to mm-hmm. To learn from.
Let me ask you, so how did Making Love come to you? How did
Making Love, that was certainly a life-changing experience for me. I was, my partner at the time was Scott Berg, and I had just done a lot of these big, star-driven movies, which kind of, these glossy love stories, comedies, romantic comedies. And I was just turning 30 and really kind of looking for a new direction to go in as a writer. I wanted to write more serious movies that more tapped into personal experience. And Scott was very instrumental in saying, why don't you write about, your own experience as a gay man and coming out? And this was, in the early 1980s,
mm-hmm.
and at the time when people just weren't out of the closet.
Right.
And the idea of writing a movie that was so personal and so, a deeply tied to my own life experience was pretty daunting. And I resisted it. And I said, wow, I don't know if I can dig that deep. I don't know if I can go to those places.
And
And at the same time, knowing if I were to write it, I'd also, need to come out publicly to give the film some legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
So I really resisted, and he kept pushing, and I must say, he kept pushing and saying, you've got to do this, and broke me down finally, and I said, the only thing is, I don't want to write it on spec, because I don't want to, pour my blood and guts into this thing, and have everybody say, no, we're not going to do a gay movie.
Right.
So I said, let's go to a studio and see if we can develop the film, that if the script turns out well, that they'll make it. At least I need that assurance to know they'll make it. Sure. So we went to 20th Century Fox. Scott had a good friend who was in development, Claire Townsend at Fox. And Sherry Lansing was the first female studio head at the time. Gosh. And we pitched it to them, and they said, yes, let's do it. And I think it took a woman head of a studio, two women actually, to get this through at that time, because I don't think any man at that time, straight or gay,
would have been open to doing something would have been like open that. To something.
But it took two women pioneers to get this film made, and they said, let's develop this. I knew if they were willing to make it, that I could write the script that they would make. So Scott and I worked on it, and I went off and wrote we developed the story together, and I went off and wrote the script, and turned it in, and sure enough, they said, let's go with it. Dan Melnick, who had just signed a producing deal there, was a big producer at the time, had done Close Encounters and All That Jazz and Altered States, and had just signed a deal at Fox and came aboard, and they gave it to him, and he said, I want to do this movie. Mm-hmm. Again, a social pioneer. Mm-hmm. And it was the first major studio to present a positive image of a gay person. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up, and this generation grew up seeing films where gay people were either butts of jokes or pathetic characters or suicidal or feminine, jumped off a bridge.
These were men.
Yes. Yeah, like, the, I mean, yeah. You know, yeah.
And women too. I mean,
because right before your film, the only experience we had with that, like when we talk about being comedic, like we remember La Caja Falls.
Yeah. Yeah.
Norman, Is That You?
Yeah.
It was just like.
Yeah,
just,
buffoons, gay people were the butts of jokes. Yeah. Buffoons. And also, you know, the movies like The Children's Hour. Remember Shirley MacLaine committing suicide because she couldn't, she was so ashamed of being gay.
Oh, God, that movie just tears me up when I think about it.
Or advising consent, Don Murray character committing suicide.
Right.
I mean, The Celluloid Closet does a terrific job of portraying the history of gay and lesbian people in film and how they were, you know, always considered, you know, these negative stereotypes.
Right.
And this movie broke through that. This movie was the first movie to present a positive role model of a gay man who accepts his homosexuality, comes out of the closet, and finds happiness and pride and gratification as a gay man. And, you know, there'd never been the statement in movies before, in American films certainly not. And it was a pretty audacious statement to make, but Fox was willing to do it. And Sherry Lansing stood up before the board and said, I want to make this movie, getting resistance on her own from the people around her. But she stood tough, and we made the movie, and it was groundbreaking in that
were
regard.
Were you able to be on the set for
Yes, that? Absolutely. I was there every minute. In fact, working with Arthur Hiller, who was a terrific director and had done a lot of, did Love Story, remember, and Hospital and the Americanization of Emily.
My God, if you have not seen Hospital or have not read that script, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. Yes.
George C. Scott, please.
Yes, that's right. The In-Laws, he directed.
Yes.
So, he was a prominent director and a wonderful...
God, yes.
He was terrific, Arthur. And wanted me there. Listen, also wanted me there as the only gay man who was out of the closet.
Because he was the only gay writer, right?
Yes. Arthur Hiller,
in all of Hollywood, you were it.
Yeah, right. So he wanted me there for just, as a technical advisor.
Right.
Barry, how do they stand this way? Do they stand this way? And Harry
Hamm. Do they stand this way?
Well,
you got to remember, in context.
Well, let's put it this
way. That's what I know.
Let's put it this way. I met, when we shot in the alley behind Book Circus on Santa Monica.
Oh, really?
That alley?
No, I don't know.
2 a.m, that alley. You know, do they stand that way at 2 a.m. in that alley? Is what he meant.
Right.
And Harry Hamlin, God bless him, was terrific.
And
Mike Lonkin, both of them.
God,
yeah,
I know.
Two straight guys, and it was pretty risky in 1982 to play gay and to kiss another man on screen.
Did you find during the casting process for that were there resistance from actors from even?
Oh, total resistance. We went to every major name, and they said, no way am I going to play gay.
What do you think it was about these two guys who said, fuck that?
They weren't, in that top league yet. They were, Harry was up and coming, had done Clash of the Titans.
Yeah.
And Michael had done Slapshot and had done some television series. Mm-hmm. But they weren't, in that A-level, top league, Harrison Ford, Dustin Hoffman league yet. So they were, and they were both pretty brave actors. They were willing to, to do that. And Kate Jackson was terrific. Mm-hmm. You know, she was a major star because she was Charlie's Angels.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And it was important to cast somebody that the audience was familiar with to sort of guide them through.
Right.
And she had been in people's homes, and you know, Charlie's Angels was a huge hit series. And she was terrific and wanted to do it. And she was kind of the guide through this, you know, kind of forbidden territory. And at the end of the movie, when she accepts her husband's, you know, decision to, you know, to live life honestly as a gay man, and she was accepting of it, then, you know, subconsciously the audience would as well. That was the intention.
Yeah, because I remember there was a line, I can't remember off the top, but there's something where she keeps digging him, like, what is wrong?
Yeah.
What's going on with him? What's going on with him? And finally she says something like, is it another woman? Like, whatever it is, I could just deal with it.
Deal with
that type of thing.
Yeah.
Like, fucking just tell me already.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly, right.
It's interesting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's like real shit to me. It's like they were friends, you know, even though they were, you know, married and in love and stuff. But because he still loved her.
Yes.
Right.
Which is one of the things I loved. You didn't make it so that he was like, you know, we haven't slept with each other in 3 years, so, you know, this is going to be easy for me to leave.
Right.
Yeah. No, I love this.
Yes,
right,
absolutely.
Right.
Yes. So I got to deal with this.
And it makes it complicated, and it brings all that dilemma and all of that angst to that that situation.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What year was Making Love? Because I want to...
82. 82.
It came out in 83.
Because I want to... It was 82, because I'm trying to remember... because I remember that movie came out. I accidentally got to see it because my mom didn't know what it was. She just dropped me off at the movies. You know, it was a movie. You go, and I'm going to shop and go do that. But there was another, I'm trying to think, because I remember seeing that and then thinking of another movie that I got to see what was considered forbidden at the time. Oh, Cruising. What year was Cruising?
Oh, Cruising was before that. Cruising
came before,
but Cruising was a pretty ugly sort of movie.
It was. Because I just remember when
about
that time, because I think in terms of me being a kid watching a film and understanding sexuality, Making Love was such a 180 from Cruising. You know, I don't want to get my mom in trouble for letting her know I go out to all these movies, but you know, hey, you go to the movies. That's what you do. And I just remember what a revelation it was because it was like, God damn, people, they're just people. People are people.
Yeah.
You know, and being at a young age and watching these films and seeing that and realizing, man, grown-ups are really stupid.
Well, to see how far we've come, you know, since 82, I remember audiences, watching that movie with audiences, when the two men kissed, they would, you know, go berserk. People would storm up. The moans and the gasps. But people would storm up the aisles. They couldn't take it. I mean, this was 1982.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, you know, the beginning of the Reagan era. We were living in a very conservative time.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And
AIDS was coming out.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We were just at the start of it. Yeah. And you know, look how far we've come now with television. I mean, it's a common thing to see two guys.
It's funny because that movie, like, what is it, like every 10 years they have like a big
anniversary screening.
Outfest
did a 30th anniversary.
Right.
A couple years ago.
Right.
It was terrific. Mm. Yeah.
It's a classic movie. I mean, you did a couple movies that are classic. I guess that one's just, as a gay man, that one moves me the most just because it was so prolific.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I love about that movie, I know we're talking about it a lot, but one of the things I love about that movie in particular is, you know, I was just a kid when it came out, probably like 9 or something, whatever.
See, and I was only 10 when I wrote it, so. Just kidding.
Anyway.
Just kidding.
Or maybe 10, whatever.
Right.
But it was the first time, and I didn't really know what it meant yet, but I knew that I was.
Yeah,
I don't remember how I saw the movie, but I remember being so intrigued by how sexy it felt.
Interesting.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. It makes sense.
Usually when I see these gay films at Outfest, I can't stand them because it's just all butt and ass and you know what I mean? No reason for them to be naked. Yours was like, let me show you this tension build to when they finally do. It freaking makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They earned it.
Hilliard, interesting. Here's the contrast. See, when I was 9 or 10 and would see and also discovering these feelings and not quite knowing what they were, but knowing, you know, there's something different. And I would see an image of a gay man who would slit his throat when he found out he was gay. Yeah. That was the difference. And suddenly my generation would say, oh, my God, I can't be that. You know, so you'd repress it and you'd be tormented by it, you know. And no good.
Mm-hmm.
No good.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Mm. All right, but I just wanted to go off on that. And also Roberta Flack the freaking theme song.
The theme song.
I mean, yep. That's it. It was Making Love. So let's skip over a couple stuff because I really want to spend time talking about Knock 'Em Dead.
Yes.
But let's just give a list of the other few films.
Well, then Crimes of Passion, which was, that's true. That's another become a cult film.
Yes.
We just had a 30th anniversary screening 2 weeks ago in Montreal at the International Film Festival. Wow. Yeah. And then we had a 30th anniversary at Outfest in July.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Also. Okay. So that film is endured too. Right. Kathleen Turner, Anthony Perkins. A really, you know, a daring, very explicit, sexually graphic film about the psychology of sexuality. I mean, it's a pretty dark, intense film. And she's amazing.
I'm hearing a theme in some of the writing that you do.
Absolutely.
You know, we all have
a thing. Right.
You're absolutely right. It's so interesting you say that because I'm teaching a class next semester, and the voice of the screenwriter, and how screenwriters do have themes that emerge in their work that transcend often the work of the director.
Right.
Yes. And I think it's important for screenwriters to know that, to know that they can have a voice, and they can have a sensibility that's distinct and unique. I think it's important for all of us as writers to know that we have that voice and that we can express it, and we should express it. And I want students to know that, and I want to show them examples of how that manifests itself in movies, for sure.
That's a good class. I mean, we've taught quite a few classes on, you know, how to find that voice and whatever.
Yes.
But I'm always looking at the different themes that people are always writing about certain things. And usually, like we always say, it's always subconscious.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's
clearly
true.
Not aware.
Yes.
And then you get the body of work and you're like, holy moly.
Oh my God, I always write about.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. No, I definitely have a specific themes that I write about, for sure. Yeah. Okay. Right.
So, what else? Let's just give us a couple of lists of some of the other movies, and then let's get into
I did a film called All American Murder with Christopher Walken and Charlie Schlatter and Joanna Cassidy, which is a murder mystery set on a college campus, also dealing with similar themes. I did a movie with Katherine Heigl called Evil Never Dies.
That was pretty recent, last like.
Yeah, it was a few years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've worked on and off, and you know, the last few years I've been teaching writing, but then I have the Knock 'Em Dead, which just.
Well, let me jump to that really quick. What made you move into teaching? Because as instructors ourselves.
Well.
You clearly moved out of L.A.
I was looking. Yeah, I had written most of my life and got a lot of movies made, and you know, it's a tough business. You know, getting films made and then working and seeing the work, you know, not always come out the way you want it, and oftentimes it's a struggle to get it made. And you know, I was going through a point in my life where I was starting to feel, you know, I need to take a break from this. I need to kind of, you know, recharge. And I had taught off and on. I remember I taught at the Gay Center here. I did a voluntary screenwriting class to raise money for AIDS awareness in the 80s, and loved the experience and thought, boy, I'd love to do more of this. Mm-hmm. And about 10 years ago, I was just going through this reexamination of where I wanted to go with my career. And a couple friends of mine said, you know, why don't you consider teaching more on a full-time basis? And I thought about it, and someone had alerted me to the fact that they were looking for an opening at the University of Central Florida, which is the second largest university in the country, for somebody to teach screenwriting. Yeah. Right. So I thought, well, I'll check it out. I'll investigate it. So I contacted them, and I sent them in my resume, and they flew me out to, you know, interview.
Child, they took a look at their resume, and it's like, you know what? Give him the tickets.
They flew me out to meet everyone and interview, and a week later, they offered me a job with tenure, which is
from jump.
So it's kind of an offer you can't refuse. So I thought, well, I'll give it a year and just, you know, I take the year and see how I like it and if I like the experience. And I took the year and just fell in love with the place. Fell in love with the idea of being in that environment, in that college environment, being around that enthusiasm and excitement, and being able to you know, take what I've learned in my own experience and knowledge and impart it to students. And it's just a terrific experience. I've been doing, and I stay there ever since. Mm-hmm. I come back to L.A. every summer for 3 months.
Yeah, because that's usually when I see.
This is my home base. Sure. And I love being back here, and we'll come back here eventually, you know, for good. But right now, I'm having a great time. You know, it's
cool. Looking all tan like he lives in Florida.
Relaxed. He's not a guy. He's out there.
He's not even working.
Right.
On the
yachts,
you know.
Which I'm very appreciative when you have working screenwriters, people who have been there, who do go back and teach and don't just kind of retire and, you know, go off in the sunset. Well, because I think it's so important for writers that are coming up to really get hands-on from someone who's been there.
Absolutely.
Someone who has sat, who's still sitting in there writing it and doing it, you know, and still, you know, getting hands-on real stuff, as opposed to, we talk about all the time, you have like the gurus, which is fun. That's great for you get inspired by.
There's a need for that.
Yeah. But there's a difference between people who teach you either from the reader side in terms of working in as a script analyst who, I am one of the gatekeepers, let me tell you how to do this, and someone who's also an actual screenwriter who's had stuff produced.
Absolutely.
And like, here's the shit. This is what I work with, and this is what you need to know.
Look,
and that's so
invaluable. When I was at UCLA Film School, we would have professional writers come in and talk to students, and it was so important, so valuable, and I learned so much from that, you know, as much as I learned from just, you know, a regular teacher. So I thought that was really important, and I knew that, and I thought, you know, it was important then to convey that to students. The other thing is, you know, working on Knock 'Em Dead, when we shot the film, I would keep a diary, and every day I would email my students, my writing students. I had to teach a class in screenwriting.
You're gonna do a little book on that.
Okay.
Yes, and I would say, this is what we did today, and these are the you know, you can write a script, but sometimes when you're shooting, problems, you know, encounter, whether it's weather, whether it's casting or whatever it is, and I would say, well, this is what happened today, and this is how we had to rework the scene, because
real practical stuff.
Yes, practical stuff. So every day we do. So I was able to then use the experience of making the movie as a teaching device as well. Mm-hmm. So that was important too.
So I love that.
Now we're here at Knock 'Em Dead.
Yes.
So let's talk about the origins of it. How you wrote it, and how you eventually cast the black cats. I think. That's
okay. Like, yes.
That's
absolutely. David Dakota, who I mentioned.
The director.
The director who I knew from Crimes of Passion, Craft Services, and he went on to a very successful career doing primarily low budget horror. Mm-hmm. But we always talked about working together and made great friends. And he and I went to Regent. Entertainment with the idea for this movie, and we developed it there. And this is a while back, and they didn't go through. They didn't make the film, and we were, you know, very frustrated. And we were able to get we were trying to get the film made other places, and not having a lot of luck. And finally, David said to me one day, he said, "Look, let's just make it ourselves. You know, let's just do it for a much lower budget and try to, you know, scrape the money together ourselves and make the movie." So
thank God you kept it contained in that big
thing. Well, I did rewrite it, because when we developed it at Regent, it was a little more expansive.
Yeah,
more
right.
But
right.
yes, but right. I got the rights back from Regent and had the script, you know, was able to get the rights back and have the script on our own. And I scaled it way down so that we could confine it to one basic setting and was able to contain it into that setting. And we're ready to go. And we put up the money ourselves.
Wow.
Not a lot, but we knew.
You'll get it back on Netflix and all that other shit.
Well, that's, you know, that's 2014, 2015. That's the way you make movies today.
Right.
So you can go out and, you know, and shoot a movie for a much lower budget.
Right.
And then you know, there are a lot of venues like Netflix and VOD and that you can, you know, get your money back on. And that, you know, that you can find an audience with at the same time. And David said to me one day, he said, "I have a great idea for casting." Because I had written the script, just, you know, as I would write any script, just, you know, with characters and an idea of this cast and crew coming together for the, not a reunion, but for the sequel. Mm-hmm. He said, "Let's cast it all African-American." I said, "That's a great idea."
Then what made him, what do you think?
He just said, he thought, "Let's do it." I mean, it's never been done where you write a script and just, you know, cast it totally African-American.
And he's a white dude, too, just so you know, without his love. I think good.
Yeah. And let's just cast it with all African-American actors and just play it as we normally would. Good. I said that's...
It's not about color.
It's not about color. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The only interesting thing is the actors in the movie, the actors, the producer, the director, the lawyer are all African-American. Mm-hmm. But the maid and butler are white, played by white people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
Oh, I see. That's right. Funny. That's good.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And
you need to teach a class on that. That's real shit.
That's right.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny because I have one of my colleagues at UCF, an African-American guy. We were going to co-teach a class in how white directors and black directors perceive a race.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd show, you know, I would show Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and he would show Mo Better Blues or, you know, mm-hmm. whatever, and that, you know, interesting enough. So we've been talking about that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, going back to Knock 'Em Dead, so not a word was changed. I mean, it plays exactly mm-hmm. as written. Mm-hmm. And it's terrific. I mean, it's a great cast. Look, also, when you're doing a movie on that kind of a tight schedule and tight budget, you need total professionalism.
Right.
The actors, you know, you can't pull any diva shit. You got to know your lines. And everybody was a total pro.
And those are people who've been in the business for a long time.
Absolutely.
And they know. And they want to work. And they want to put out some good product.
Let's talk about casting. How did you guys get those actors?
Well, we had a really terrific casting director, Jan Glazer. And... she would send us, you know, links to videos and photos, and I would go on, and you know, David and I worked on this together, and we just like, for example, they sent a link to Deborah Wilson's stuff for Mad TV. Remember mm-hmm. where she would do her Oprah imitations, mm-hmm. And hysterical. She's mm-hmm. so funny. I said, we have to have Deborah in this movie. You know, she's just too talented. Enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's how, we, you know. Now, you know, not every actor was willing to do it at that budget, you know. I know that, you know, because, you know, it was a short schedule, and they worked for scale. 6 days.
Oh, wow. What?
Yeah.
What?
Oh, my God. I thought you were going to say 14 days or some shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are some long hours.
Yeah. Well, when you see the film tonight, you'll see how good David is, because you never know it. Because people have seen the film, mm-hmm. they think, well, you must have had, like 30 days or something?
Right, right.
Mm-mm. So,
I'll
actually,
have David on the show. I want to interview him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is he here?
He's here. Absolutely. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's great. He's great. Yeah.
Especially because we know more of his movies.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, he'll do it. Yeah, he'll love it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You'll see him tonight, sure.
Okay, cool.
But it's the best cast I ever worked with. They're just absolutely terrific.
You know, because they're black folks.
You bet.
We just got it like that.
You bet. No, but everybody, they knew that, you know, to make this movie at that budget and that schedule, they had to know their lines. They had to mm-hmm. come. And, you know, it was a long drive out to the set. We shot in the Malibu Hills, and, you know, it's a 45-minute drive every day. Mm-hmm. You know, what if there's a flat tire, or what if there's an accident, or, you know, and they're, you know, 3 hours late on that schedule, mm-hmm. you know, it could really fuck
and
things
everybody's
up.
Everybody's there almost every day because it's so content.
Right,
yes, everybody
right.
was there every day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but we were lucky. You know, it was really 5 days shoot. The sixth day was the Amorosa scene, which is a separate scene, as you'll see tonight. So it's really a 5 day shoot with all the actors. But, you know, David would light the scene and line up the shots while I was running lines with the actors. And, you know, everything was very tightly coordinated, and it went off, you know, without any problem. I mean, we were very lucky.
Wow.
We're very lucky. And the actors, and they're totally supportive of the film. I mean, mm-hmm. they've been to every screening, and mm-hmm. they've, you know, brought their friends.
Like I said, we were going to screen it at the Writers Guild the other night. And I didn't tell you this story. So let me tell you the story real quick. So when you go to the Writers Guild to go see a screening, if you're there early, people have to wait in the lobby, right? So I get there, and usually I can just go up because I'm part of the committee. And I get there, and he's like, oh, you got to wait. And I was like, I'm part of the committee. Like, motherfucker, you know who I am? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm here all the time. I talk to you all the time. And he's like, yeah, but, you know, they're having an issue upstairs and yada, yada, yada. And I look to my right, and I see Omarosa standing there like, how long is this going to last? And she heard me say I'm one of the committee. Mm-hmm. And I turned to her and said, hey, Omarosa. She goes, hey. And I said, look, we can't, she's one of the stars of the movie. We can't have her sitting down here looking like this. I said, let me just take her up. Because it was like a room full of people. Mm-hmm. So let me just take her up so it doesn't look all crazy in here. So I did that. I brought her up.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So, you know
great.
What I mean? Yeah. And I brought her up and, you know. She,
thank you for doing yeah. that. Yeah.
It was just mainly because it just didn't look good.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't mm-hmm. see any of the other stars at the time. Mm-hmm. But I recognized her and brought her up. We talked all the way up the elevator and I realized, yeah. oh my God, Omarosa, you know Pamela? Blah, blah, right. blah. So we get into this whole conversation.
Right.
She was so sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, she really is. Mm-hmm. She's a sweetheart. She's mm-hmm. just terrific. And very, very funny in the yeah. movie. You'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And people are going to be very surprised.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. But, and Jack Kay is terrific, too. Yeah, she's great. Yeah. Yeah. And she's going on Queen Latifah, I think, in the next couple of weeks, too.
Oh, really?
To, yeah. Mm-hmm. To talk good. About the film. Yeah.
Because so. Everybody's out promoting the film for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah.
Because I wonder, I was at, where was I? Did you have like some promotional posters out like
yes.
some weeks back?
Yes.
Because I was over at Dark Delicacies, Hi Dale, yeah. my horror bookstore. And I remember I was going in because, you know, I had to go get my action figures. And Dale always has my stuff. I know, I cleaned my car out and I took some stuff out of my car and I realized, dang, I didn't bring my action figures. But when I went in, I was, you know, usually he has like, a lot of posters, a lot of movie stuff, anything mm-hmm. horror or anything like that. So as I'm leaving out, I always look on the side thing to see, oh, what's a new movie? And I remember seeing the flyer on there, I'm like, what movie is this with all these black actors that I know? Like, mm-hmm. what movie is this? And I was just like looking at him like, oh my God, like, where is this coming out? I remember picking it up and seeing all the faces on there. I was mm-hmm. like, oh, it's a horror and it's a comedy. Because you know one of my pet peeves is I like my horror pure. Mm-hmm. But if you can make it funny where it's organic to the story
yes.
and
yeah.
still give me my scares,
yeah. Yeah.
I'll go along with it. But I remember seeing the flyer for that, like, oh, let me grab this and let people know when this comes out, you know? I was like, oh, my gosh, I know these people on here. It's like, I got to see this movie. And that's when I was looking and grabbing some other things, too. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. Who did this?
I'm still stuck on this.
Yeah, six days.
Damn.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I tell you gotta get some pros.
Yeah.
When you gotta do a tight shoot like that yeah. and have them prepared.
Well, this is the key. I mean, and I tell this to my students as well. If you're doing this kind of a low budget, micro budget film,
right.
preparation, that's the key. David knew exactly what he was going to shoot,
mm-hmm.
Where he was going to shoot it. He knew that location, every inch of it, and he knew which scenes and I mean, where to put the actors in each scene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that you have to be prepared.
How much rehearsal time did you have before getting on set? Did you have a little
well,
time
we,
to...
Well, we right before we started shooting, I flew in and I was here the week before. And we met with the actors, the three leads, the three women. And we went through the script. So we did a read-through. Okay. And so, you know, they got a feeling for the characters. And then any, you know...
So it's focused on them mainly. They have all the...
Primarily, but... you know, they were available at that time, and they wanted to do it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in terms of rehearsal, like when David, you know, was working, you know, doing the lighting and the setting up the shot, mm-hmm. I would be in the other room going through running lines and rehearsing with the actors mm-hmm. too. So, and they wanted to. I mean, certain actors want to just, you know, do it, and the other actors want to
that's
rehearse.
That's what pros do.
Right. Yeah.
They want to do it. And a lot of them come from theater too, so they go back and forth.
Right.
So they
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. Right. But they wanted to run lines just so they would make, you know, because again, there's a, when you're doing, and the, with that cast, it was 5 days because, so the Omarosa was the extra day. There's a lot of dialogue to learn, and it's a lot of dialogue in the film. So they wanted to make sure they knew the lines. So they were, you know, intent on running lines. They really mm-hmm. wanted to just so they would, you know the lines. And,
right.
You know, the more they said it, the more they would get it, you know.
Okay.
You know,
oh,
talking,
yeah, but I really wanted to have you on the show. I mean, you have a super amazing career. Right.
Oh my God! Like you just googled. I was looking in there. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh my God! He did that one too. He wrote that one and then that one.
And there's things on there.
After right. a while, I was just like, you know what? Oh, there's more stuff on there. Oh my gosh!
You don't get all your IMDb credits.
Yeah.
That's crazy. But yeah, I wanted to have you on particularly. I wanted to talk about Making Love, of course, because that was historic for me personally, mm-hmm. and also because of Knock 'Em Dead, because you know. Let's just get it out there. I mean, you're a white, you know, a writer and producer, and as is your director, David, and you guys changed the game. You're like, why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we try this another way? Which is what you always say.
Mm-hmm.
Make it a woman instead of a man.
Right, switch it up.
You know,
yeah.
Switch it up a little bit. And you guys were a great example. So I really hope all you listeners go and see Knock 'Em Dead on Vimeo Demand, all those other places. Is it out now or is it about to
come? Tomorrow, November 7th.
Okay, it's
Friday,
November 7th,
yeah.
guys.
Okay.
It'll be out. So let's just Is there anywhere people can find you right quick? You got a, something?
Oh, I got it.
If anyone's in the Los Angeles area, on Saturday night, we're having the premiere. You're all welcome to come. No charge. It's at the Arena Theater on Las Palmas, right behind the Egyptian Theater at 8:30 Saturday night. It's the red carpet premiere. And all are welcome. So if you're around Los Angeles,
all the stars will be there.
The stars will be there. Okay. Yep. Photographers, all that. Yeah. All right. So if you're around 8:30.
There'll be a lot of black folks in there, a lot of white folks.
You bet. You bet. Yes.
Well, That'll be fun.
Are you on Twitter?
No, I'm not. No, I'm now, still living in the dark.
It's 2014.
No, I know. I know.
You got to hit me up a little bit. You got the tan. You know?
It'll come. I'm very slow to all these things, but I eventually do them. But you know, I'm slow to the game.
So you're still on MySpace, right? Is that what it is?
Yeah, right. But I still have one of those phones where you hand crank it and call Millie down at the general store. Like, you know. So.
Rexville 25, please.
Yeah, right.
It's not there. Oh, darn it.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Barry.
Thank you, Hilliard. Thank you, Lisa. It was great.
It's going to be a lot of fun for that movie.
So we're going to go see it.
Knock him dead.
Great.
So there's a little segment we do.
Yes.
Lisa has that she calls the clap.
It's just the clap back. And basically what it is, it's like if something's happening in Hollywood or in pop culture and I feel I must speak on it, whether it's positive or negative.
Tell the people.
But here's the thing. I'm really excited because, you know, the Sci-Fi Channel just announced that they're actually going to kind of go back to what the Sci-Fi Channel is supposed to be about in terms of their content. Because I know right now Sci-Fi has been known for, like, Sharknado and, you know, come on. Those are fun. I know. Where it's CGI. Yeah. Like, it's like seventh grade CGI. It's like, really? Y'all couldn't have improved that? But you know what? Those type of movies are fun. You know, when it's a Sunday, a lot of times I'll put the Sci-Fi Channel on. A lot of those movies I've seen before, you know, they're just fun. Fun, silly, popcorn, not taken seriously kind of thing. True. Every now and then they put in a couple of like classic horror movies or sci-fi, you know, that kind of thing. But I guess they realize they don't want to be corny anymore.
Oh, really?
Yes. They want to be taken seriously. So basically what they're doing is they're coming out with five new projects that are more, I don't want to say respectable, but like legitimate sci-fi, like what we thought the Sci-Fi Channel was really going to be about, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But one of the projects I'm actually really looking forward to see, and I hope they do it right, is Ascension. When I saw Nightcrawler, I saw one of the trailers that were talking about the Sci-Fi Channel. I'm like, oh my God, they're bringing like, because they had Helix and a couple other series shows. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my God, they're really trying to do something different, but they're also trying to bring back good, real, hardcore sci-fi. So I just want to give a little shout out and a little clap back, like Sci-Fi Channel, thank you. For the love of God. Like I've been rolling with y'all from day one. I've been rolling with you guys when you made the name change to SYFY. I mean, I was there with you.
That was cool.
I tried to hold on to your integrity. I enjoyed the fandom of Sharknado and Crockett. I mean, look. Yesterday, I was like doing some reading and doing some stuff, and I had the Sci-Fi Channel on just in the background. And I looked up and I said, does this bitch got Tiffany and, oh God, what's the girl that sang that, like pop stars like in the 80s? I think it's Tiffany and Debbie Gibson. And I thought, and like literally, I mean, I think it was them because I didn't take the time to IMDb. But I looked up and I go, ain't this some, this is Tiffany and Debbie Gibson fighting a shark. No, it was an alligator and some baby giant ginormous snakes, and the computer graphics were horrible. Oh, they were like back like in the 80s when we were learning computer programming, where you know it's like return to five. It was just
shoot them all in Canada.
And you know what? And it was just
not
horrible.
Canada isn't good, but I mean
no. But then when I saw the trailer for Ascension, and I was like, oh my God, this could be actually something really good. And then to go home and just see. It was like, you have stepped your game up, Sci-Fi. Hopefully these other shows will improve. Mm-hmm. I really hope you do. There's a lot of real serious sci-fi content that needs to be made. If you do this, trust me, the fans will come. You will up your viewership. But I have to say, it's time for us to like put to bed those... And I love Roger Corman because I know a lot of these productions and stuff are coming from his company. And, you know, I'm a ride or die chick for Roger Corman. Yeah, or Asylum. Mm-hmm. I'm a ride or die for that because I do appreciate that. Because, you know, you can't always be serious and you got to have some silly fun stuff too. Sure. But I think right now it's kind of overwhelmed the Sci-Fi Channel. And, you know, you maybe just have a Sunday silly, you know, a block of programming,
yes.
like maybe 4 hours on Sunday from like 11 a.m. to whatever. And I mean, I hate to be doing somebody's job in programming, you know, but I'm just saying, as a fan who is trying to help
maybe,
you.
Maybe that's where you should be a development producer. That's where you should be assumed.
You know, because me being a sci-fi writer and knowing sci-fi writers and knowing a lot of beautiful content that should be up there, like you really need to step your game up, sci-fi. So I'm hoping this is going in the right direction. You know, I'll give you a couple more years and we may have to break up. But I've been loyal from day one. Okay. So Sci-Fi Channel, yay you for trying to come up a little bit.
I think they need to start watching more BBC and learn how it's done.
Can we just change? Then... You know what? Look, that's all I do now. Like, I switch it over and I'm like, I'm just going to, I feel like I'm straying, like I'm cheating. But every now and then I do have to go to BBC America. Like, let me see my Orphan Black and my other stuff over here. Like, some real serious, you can have the speculative element, but at the same time, some serious character and good stuff. So, sci-fi, let's keep the sillies to Sundays between like 11 and 4. You know, and
a small window.
A small window.
That's like two shows.
You know
what?
Because I trust me. I love Sharknado and all that silliness, but I can't take it 24/7. Every time I turn on the channel, the same damn sets. You know, I made five movies, and I know it's like the old Hammer school. You know, the old school. You know, we got to use these sets, and I know it's the old school. You know what? We gonna make 15 movies out of this bitch. We only got this for 2 more weeks, but it's time to step your game up. You've got a brand. We need to rebrand that brand and make it serious. You're the only thing out there. You're the only thing I have.
Because I'm watching, there's a show called Z Nation.
Right? Yes.
Which is a zombie show.
Yes.
Right.
And it's trying to compete with Walking Dead.
Yes. You cannot. You need to stop. Stop it, Z Nation.
We were watching, I was showing my partner Scott last night the season premiere this year. Of season 5
right.
of The Walking Dead, which is fucking badass.
Are you watching
The Walking
Dead?
Oh, yeah, every episode.
Okay.
You bet.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So look, and they all burst out of Terminex, right? Terminus.
Yes.
So they burst out of there, and you know, everybody fighting everybody, and Rick is trying to find a way out, and the zombies, the horde is coming through because Carol let them in.
Right.
Right? They're coming in, and they are like, fuck, like, we can't be seen. You watch Z Nation, they're like, oh, it's just 100 of them. You know what I mean? Like, there's no fear.
There's no realism. At all. Yeah, there's no realism to it. Yeah, and plus,
unless they're stuck in a room and a bunch of them are, then they're worried.
And let's be honest, you kind of really don't care about the characters on Z Nation. I mean, because let's be honest, The Walking Dead really is not about the zombies.
No,
it's true. It's about the people. Yeah, it's about
and that's what makes that show work. Right. That's what makes that show work. Compared, and you know, much respect to Z Nation trying to do their thing, but it's like you really, number one, we got to get off the zombie tip. Like, there's other stuff out there. No. I don't know. You can't. But it's like every new show is like, and it's like zombies. Yeah, like, there are other things out there. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're going to do a Z Nation, do something. Like, you need to seriously sit your ass down, look at The Walking Dead, really think about, can we really come out with a product that compares to that? Mm-hmm. And you got to be honest, you can't. So what you got to do is come up with something totally different. Mm-hmm. And make me want to razzle dazzle and go to that. Mm-hmm. So Z Nation, hey, much respect. You're trying, boo boo, but y'all, you may get an extra season, maybe. And I do realize there's probably fans out there who like that kind of stuff. Yeah. But for people like me who like story and character and plot and likes to have those things mesh, because to give me feeling, like, bitch, you got to make me cry. You can't have me watching. Like, look, I'll say it again. How many of you guys had dry eyes out there when when Daryl and Carol and everybody was back together? Like, unless you was like a homie from the beginning and watching it, like, you, there's no way you can sit there. Or when Sasha sees, you know, her brother and they embrace and everybody's together and there's that moment. There, you even if you didn't cry, you felt something. Like, you felt a heaving. Absolutely. Like, God damn it, these people, like, that's your family. Mm-hmm. If you're not bringing that type of game to your zombie extravaganza, please, for the love of God and all things in Hollywood, bring us something new and different. Because you're not going to be able to compete. There's no way. There's no way. They're at that level now with 5 seasons. But they're like maybe going to 8 seasons,
they
maybe.
They just got picked up for 6. Okay, so you know what's coming.
I mean, honestly, I don't know how much further it can take. You know what? I lie. Every season I say this. Like, I don't know how much more I can watch. It's just, they do something that makes me come back into it. Yeah. But seriously.
But you know, you brought up a great point, Lisa, and it's a writing point, and I tell this to all my students. students too. You've got to connect with the characters.
Yes.
You know, I don't care how many zombies or how many kills, or if you don't care about those people
and
what they're going through, then that doesn't matter.
And it's nothing. It's like it's really hollow. And, and it's so hard to convey that to people because it's so easy to make a movie and, oh, blood and guts and crazy stuff. But the movies that resonate, the ones that people still talk about years later, it's those characters. And even though people love zombie movies, the zombie movies that resonate for me are the ones that it is character. When you're talking about the original Night of the Living Dead, when you're talking about 28 Days Later, when you're talking about those type, oh my God, Dawn of the Dead, you know, the 80s consumerism, like where you're just like, oh my God, I care. You got to really sit down and think about, are people going to connect to my characters? Because your characters are the ones that are going to carry us through the story. It's not the monsters. I love monsters, but it's going to be those people dealing with those monsters or crazy creatures that really pulls through. And if you're just giving us monster and it's just boring.
Agreed.
And don't be basic. Don't be a basic bitch with your horror.
We're going to leave him with
We're going to leave with that. Don't be a basic bitch with your horror. Right. Please.
Why don't we call this the rant room? And we might go to the left.
Got it.
Well, thanks a lot, Barry.
It was great. Thanks.
Yes.
It was
terrific.
Again, all you listeners, go check out Knock 'Em Dead. Like you said, it's going to be premiering here in Hollywood. If you guys want to come see it, at what theater?
Saturday night.
This Saturday night.
November 8th. Yep.
November 8th. Yeah.
The Arena Theater at 8:30.
That's what's up. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, after starting tomorrow, November 7th.
It'll be on video on demand.
Yeah.
Yep.
You can get it on video demand anywhere else.
Comcast, Amazon, iTunes.
And it'll be on
Verizon.
DVD in
February.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
So that's what's up. Lisa, where you at?
I'm on Twitter. You can also find me on BitchFlix.
She's staff writer.
Yeah, it's a lot. Just, you know, writing about film criticism from a feminist lens. And I know people get scared when they hear the word feminist. It's just basically how I talk and how I sound and what I talk about on here is the same stuff when it's writing. So you're just going to see it in the writing. And let's see, what else? Yeah, Twitter and BitchFlix, you know. And if you hook up on Twitter, you'll see the link to BitchFlix. So come holler at me.
That's what's up. And again, I'm your host, Hilliard.
One more again.
I'm your host, Hilliard Gass, you are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room.
Do you know where you are right now?
I have no
idea. That's why you can't be eating those French chocolate donuts in front
of
us.
I'm starving to death.
Are you really? Oh my God.
Anyway, that's what happens when you be lifting weights. So I'm your host, Hilliard Gass. You can find me on Twitter. You can listen to the show on Twitter. You can follow us and see what we're doing on there at ScreenwritersRR. If you guys want to email us anything to me and Lisa, or if you want me to say anything to Barry, no, I will not send him your script. Then you go get that. Hey, I write murder mystery too. Can you send it to Barry? Yeah. No, motherfucking no.
And make sure you go back and see his library of work. Go through and just...
Like he got time for you.
Yeah. Just...
see how we are, man. We stupid. So look. No, we will not send it to him. But, let me give you guys a couple little shout-outs. We are doing really, really well in Australia. Shout-out to England. Shout-out to Russia. We in Russia. Mm-hmm. Can you believe that?
Oh, and London just had their London screenwriting conference over there. So
there's a girl who keeps shouting us out over there.
Oh, God, we've got to go.
Yeah.
Like,
she puts us on our blog all the time.
Well, thank you, because we got to come over there for those screenwriters, because you guys are, the sledge is real, and we just want to come over there and just touch English soil.
Holla at us. We'll
come over there. Rub it on us and bring it back to the writers here, because we need some help.
We'll come talk to y'all. We'll come holler at y'all, give y'all a little lesson.
Hey, and Jasmine, put your $20 down, dude. Nightcrawler. Jake Gyllenhaal. And I'll put you on blast, son. Have the Doritos ready.
That's what's up. So, yeah, I just want to give a couple shouts out to a couple of those different countries. Oh, and Canada. You guys are hitting Australia, I think I said. So, we appreciate it, y'all. So, we're going to give them 1,002. So, y'all know what to do. Y'all know what y'all listening to. Screenwriters Rant Room, y'all. Where we keep it street.
What?
You can join in with us, too. We're going to say 1,000.
All right.
We keep it street.
What?
We keep it opinionated. Woo-hoo. We keep it what?
Uh-huh. 1,002.
1,002.
All right. That's the button. That's the echo button on the end. Boom. There you go.
Thanks, y'all. Peace.
Ciao.
Something to get off my chest. Everyone got one. What's your opinion? This is the rant room. Tongues won't be bitten. Ain't no rules, just spill it. And anybody can get it. No limit. We get to kill it. You tuning into the thrillers. And no, ain't no stopping.
any topic, even the random.
We get to random.
I hope that you're ready. We entering in the zone soon. We on a grown shit. Welcome to the Ram Room.